This is 4:55 on Wednesday, August 28th. All right, 10:10. Yes, please sign in for attendance. Good. Working. So, are there any questions to start things out? Yes. No, just a hand wave. Okay. All right, so today we're going to start talking about Chapter 2, and the plan is to talk about various application layer issues, followed by some specific protocols, and then talk about the socket programming interface, which application programmers use to talk to networks, and we will switch for that part to the TCP Sockets in C book, rather than using the Java material from this chapter. Although you're certainly welcome to read the Java material. So, how this goes. Once again, slides from the authors of the textbook, and I'll offer my opinions and comments along the way, and certainly I hope there's some good discussion, and those of you who've done some network programming may have thoughts or questions based on your experience. Please bring those up as well. So we'll start out by talking about a few of the principles, as I said, and then we'll move into talking about some specific protocols. So, in the principles discussion, we're after sort of conceptual aspects of things, not too much in the way of details, although certainly some important information and some important parts of building your, of constructing your own personal understanding of what networking is all about, let's put it that way. And the kinds of applications that we're talking about, of course, are web, email, messaging, video streaming, voice over IP, sort of the usual things, telephony, social networking. Anything not represented here? Gaming, right? Gaming. In multi-user network games, it's represented. All right. Never mind. Okay, so here's the goal, right? The world has sort of gotten used to this to the point that we don't even think about it anymore. But when you're writing programs to use the network, you are writing programs that run on the end systems. You mostly are not ever having to think about what happens inside the network. And that's really been why it has been possible for networking to take off in the way that it has. So all of the stuff inside the network is standardized, provided off the shelf from the perspective of the end programmer. Okay? Oh, it's fancier. All right. So remember that the application and transport layers run on the end system, and the network layers and below are the only things that run inside the network. So there are two principal ways of looking at building these applications, called client-server and peer-to-peer, and you really will see that you understand the peer-to-peer in terms of the client-server. So, the client-server model says that there are two kinds of hosts in the world. There are servers and clients. And the characteristic of servers is that they are always on, right? They're sort of always approximately always on. They have permanent IP addresses, or addresses or names or something that don't change so that you can find them, right? So the clients will be able to find them. And these days, more and more, those servers are migrating into large data centers that have that have you know, lots of cooling, that they have people to support them, they have backup, they have all kinds of things that make servers support this sort of always-on model. Clients, on the other hand, are the devices that move around the network. They appear in different places, they come and go, and in the client-server architecture, they don't talk directly to each other. The peer-to-peer architecture sort of takes the viewpoint that what would be clients in the other world are talking with each other. They directly communicate. There may be some servers in the architecture that help or facilitate this direct communication between the peers, but the idea is that the peers talk directly to each other. So what are some examples of peer-to-peer protocols? Pardon? Torrents, yeah. Torrents is a big one. Sometimes voice over IP is peer-to-peer. Sometimes it's server-facilitated, so you actually connect to a server which then connects to the other guy, but sometimes what all the server does is facilitate a direct connection between the two endpoints. So peer-to-peer architectures are good in the sense that in the cases that what you really want to do is a peer-to-peer interaction. But they are difficult in that you have to be able to find the guy that you want to talk to, and that may not be so easy. The other thing here that's worth thinking about and cogitating on is that one of the problems with the client-server architecture is that as you get more and more clients, the servers sort of run out of steam, right? And then you have to go along and build new servers and sort of beef up your infrastructure. Peer-to-peer architectures have, at least in some of their aspects, the characteristic that as more peers show up, they bring more resources with them that can be used to do the service. And so this is sort of one of the reasons that I think Skype it was able to grow so fast initially was because it was using the resources of the computers that people brought with them. It also kind of got a bad reputation because it was using those resources without being very forthcoming about the fact that that's what it was doing. And so, and it was using them in fairly significant amounts. So, things you got to watch out with. Okay, so let's go back to this picture. So our model of the world, our mental model of the world, is that we have these applications and that they want to communicate with each other across a network. What is an application? Well, an application is, in some sense, a process running within a machine. A program running, you know, a program is a program, it sits there. When you execute it, it becomes a process. Right? And so you can have multiple instances of the same program running on a machine, and each one of those is separate from our viewpoint now as we talk about processes. Taken or taking 360, right? So did you do any, like, pipes or... Did you implement pipes for 360? Yes. No?
No, that's
460
you do pipes.
360 you only do IO redirection. Okay. So when you get to 460, if you haven't already, one of the things you'll be implementing is one form of communication between processes using these gadgets called pipes. There are other kinds of inter-process communication implemented on systems such as shared memory.
Right? So you can build a memory segment that multiple processes have access to, and they coordinate their reading and writing of that. There is something called OS domain sockets, which is actually going to look very much like networking by the time we're done with that. So we won't say much more about that. But if you have multiple processes inside one running operating system, you're talking about inter-process communication on the using the OS-provided facilities. If you don't have one machine, you're sort of forced to this model that says, we don't have anything to share, we can't have shared memory, it's not the same machine, so all we can do is send messages. And that's what the communication across the internet consists of, is sending of messages between machines. Now, some people in research and to a lesser extent in commercial settings have actually built inter-process communication facilities across a network that attempt to provide a shared memory abstraction even though it's across the network. These are, to my way of thinking, kind of maybe off in the wrong direction, because the network fundamentally provides messages. If you can build your applications directly over messages, you may have to warp your view of what programming is about, but by putting an intermediate layer of shared memory, I have two objections. One has to do with performance, and the other is that actually shared memory between processes is a fairly lousy programming abstraction anyway, even within a machine. So we can talk about that in the concurrent programming class in the spring if you want to get into that. Okay, so regardless of whether we're using client-server or peer-to-peer model for this sort of overall application, we're going to find that we have client processes and server processes, and sometimes processes that even do both of those things. But they're still going to have this role of somebody initiates any given communication sequence, and somebody was sort of passive about it in getting it started. So that's okay. The programming abstraction that we use to talk to networking is called a socket. It's a facility that is provided by the operating system. We will talk much more about this at the end of the chapter when we move to the other book. But basically, a socket is a resource that is acquired from the operating system. Maybe I can draw here. There. That boundary there is really important. I guess it's kind of shown here as well. That boundary between the application process and the operating system is really important because it's there that you do the interactions that allow you to do network communication from an application process. So you start out by asking the operating system for a socket and then telling the operating system what you want to do with the socket. And eventually, once you've sort of configured things, then you're able to push data out through the socket and get data back through the socket. Okay, so it acts like in Unix, it acts like a file descriptor. In Windows, it doesn't act quite so much like a file descriptor. It's called a network handle. A file handle in Windows, and it would be a socket handle in Windows. But similarly, once you get it all set up, what you do with it is you read and you write on it, right? Or send and receive. And from the applications process, once the data goes out the door of the socket, it sort of doesn't have to worry about it anymore. It will show up over there or not, depending on some of the ways that you configured the socket and the performance of the network. Okay, so how do we send data to a particular process? Well, in IP version 4, which is what we're all using these days mostly, every host has a 32-bit IP address. And we will talk much more about the format of these addresses and so on and so forth. But just know that it's a 32-bit number. It happens to have some internal structure having to do with the way networks are organized around the internet, but from the perspective of a application programmer, it's just a 32-bit number. And what that does is give us a way to send messages from one host to another. But that's not the same thing as sending from one process to another, right? Because there can be many processes running on any given host. And so we need some way to distinguish between between the different processes on a host. And so to do that, the identifier associated with the socket actually incorporates both the IP address of the host and what's called a port number. And so port numbers are standardized as being 16 bits. Okay? But it turns out that the way that they're used actually means that there are potentially many more than 64K sockets on any given host, because it turns out that in fact the identifier for a socket is not only the port number, but also in the case of TCP, the port number and IP address of who it's talking to. So you can get a sort of multiplicative effect there and actually have many, many more than 64K ports, 64K sockets active, even though they're only 64K port numbers. So port numbers are either arbitrary, right? So you can just pick one up and use it for your application, or they're standardized. And so some really common services have standard port numbers associated with them. The web typically uses port 80, and I'm sure you've all seen this, right? That's why would you see this? Do people notice port 80 in using the web? It's not a big deal. Yeah, so you might not have noticed it, actually. Well, you'll get very used to it in this class. So that's the standard port. Nothing says you have to run a server on the standard port. You can run it on any port you want to. It's just that other people wanting to contact you will expect to find it on the standard port unless you have some way of telling them otherwise. The standard SMTP mail server that we'll talk about uses port 25, but in both cases, there's a secure version of this that uses different port numbers. Right? So depending on what you're doing, the port numbers change. And then the clients use the arbitrary port number idea to determine what port number they will use, because remember, the client makes the connection to the server, right? And so the client says, I want to talk to you, server. In order to do that, it has to know the IP address and the port number. But as part of contacting the server, the client says, and I'm using a certain IP address and port number. So the server knows from that initial connection where to find the client. And we'll go through this in excruciating detail when we talk about socket programming. Okay, so what's in an application layer protocol? Basically, you have to define what the messages are. So what is their format? What do they mean? And you have some rules that say after receiving a particular message, I'm supposed to send a different kind of message. So let's think about this. It's really simple. HTTP. We'll do this again in a lot more detail. But HTTP, your browser says, get a page. The protocol says the server must respond with something that says, here's a response. It would not be appropriate for the server to respond with, get a page. You know, that's not a valid response to that message. He could say, I don't have that page. It could say, that page moved. It could say, you're not authorized to view that page. There are a lot of things it could say, but it couldn't say, get a page as a response. So that's, you know, it's just back to this basic idea of what is a protocol. It's the format of things and the order in which they can be sent. Protocols come in a lot of different flavors and are defined by different organizations. The original internet protocols, application layer, were defined by an organization called the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, and those are defined in documents called RFCs, which stands for Request for Comments. Even when they're standards, they're called Request for Comments. There's a website called the... What's it called? There's a master website that contains all of the nearly 10,000 of these documents that exist now. And they get distributed widely over the internet. And if somebody says, look up RFC number 829, you go on Google and you say RFC 829, and you will find the original and many copies of it available. But documentation of protocols is essential to actually allow people to implement them. Other organizations that define protocols are the World Wide Web Consortium, which actually is responsible for certain protocols. I was going to say HTTP, but this is suggesting that it's an RFC. I don't know. And then there are protocols that people build just to allow their own applications to talk to each other. And Skype, it works that way. You can't sort of hop onto Skype and provide your own implementation because they don't tell you how it's supposed to work. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit and think about what does an application need from the network. So, here we suggest data integrity, that if you send something to your peer on the other side, either the client or the server, it must get there, and it must get there completely intact. So some applications need that. So what are some applications that need that kind of behavior? Well, file transfer, web transactions are listed there, but you know, email, right? It would be kind of the pits if you sent email messages and chunks were missing out of the middle, or the words changed, or something like different character set. That would not be cool. On the other hand, if you're using voice over IP, you know, we're already probably going to be using some sort of lossy compression technology to get rid of to reduce the required bandwidth. So maybe some loss of those packets is okay, right? It maybe only 20 milliseconds of audio in any given packet, and you'll sort of hardly miss it. You'll hear it as a little click when you're listening to the audio. So what's the point? The point is that there's variability in the requirements of applications for data integrity. Okay? And why is that important? Because providing 100% reliability comes with a cost. We'll be exploring what that cost is But if you don't need to pay that cost, maybe you can get some benefit in the cases where you don't need it. Okay, some applications require very low delay. Has anybody ever actually talked on a satellite telephone?
Oh, yes, I have.
You have. And what was that like?
Like a 2-second delay and a lot of stuff got echoed.
A 2-second delay and a lot of stuff got echoed because you say something and, you know, the guy at the other end doesn't hear it until it's gone up there and back there, and meanwhile he started talking. And sometimes voice over IP connections have just about as bad performance, and the same thing happens. It's very unpleasant to try to converse.
News too, if they ever have a story over, you know, the Gaza Strip or something, they will always talk over each other.
Yeah. Yep. And you'd think that by now, being professionals, they would have figured out how to handle that, but they don't. So, again, okay, so some require low delay, but others don't, because, and if they don't, why should we pay for it? Similarly, throughput. You know, if you're sending video, you gotta have a lot of bandwidth, and you gotta sort of have it continuously. But other applications like file transfer, or, you know, our send a terabyte of data from New York to Los Angeles, yeah, we need a lot of bandwidth, but we don't have to have it sort of at a constant rate. We could have more or less at different times. Can we adopt to those different requirements with the networking? And finally, some applications require security, others require data integrity. Again, should we pay for it all the time or not? Well, I think, you know, in light of our earlier discussion, I think we started out with the wrong viewpoint on that. That we should probably ask ourselves very carefully whether we can get away without security, rather than assuming that we can get away without security, and then only adding it if needed. Okay, so you can look on these different dimensions for different applications. File transfer has elastic throughput, no data loss. Audio and video are pretty loss tolerant. Interactive gaming. I don't know. I don't do interactive gaming. Are you tolerant of your actions being lost when you make them in a game? Probably not. That would be my guess. I don't quite know why they chose that. But there are ways to turn things that are lossy into things that are lossless, but that's what this is all about. So I disagree. Okay, so what happened with the internet was we've got this big sort of multi-dimensional space of requirements, and the internet designers said, look, let's be simple about this and see if we can just define a couple of things that cover most of that space pretty well. And so what they came up with was what's called TCP and UDP. And they just hit two specific points in that space and then asked the applications to map onto those two points and get pretty close as a result. So TCP is used when you need reliable transport. That is, all the data that you send gets there, uncorrupted. When you need, and one way of one thing that's done in order to accomplish that is to tell the sender to slow down if the receiver isn't keeping up. So that's built into TCP. Another way of another mechanism that's used to accomplish this is what's called congestion control, which says that if the sender is going faster than the network can handle the data, the sender must slow down. Okay. But TCP does not provide anything about timing, security, throughput, or anything like that. And in order to accomplish this reliable transport, in fact, it requires that things be set up ahead of time with the receiver. Not with the network. The connection-oriented setup here is not connection-oriented in the sense that the telephone call is connection-oriented, where we actually do things in the network to make that true. But we just agree between the client process and the server process that we are now talking, we're going to be talking for a while, and we're going to do that reliably. And there's some data structures associated with that. Okay, so that's the complicated side. The simple side is the user datagram protocol service. Notice the U does not stand for unreliable, even though it is. It stands for user. Unreliable data transfer. The sender sends messages, and maybe the receiver gets them, and maybe the receiver doesn't. And if it doesn't, well, the network doesn't care less about that. It may be up to the application itself to fix any issues associated with that. It doesn't have reliability, flow control, congestion control, timing, throughput guarantee, security, or connection setup. So I think, based on the previous discussion, you should have an answer as to why there is a UDP. Because it hits some application requirements better than TCP at lower cost. Now, neither one of these things provides what? Timing, minimum throughput, or security. So how do we get those?
Is that up to each application to kind of deal with that, or is there?
Well, there's not much an application can do to improve the throughput of the network, right?
That's true. I was thinking of security. You can encrypt it.
Oh, okay. So security, yes. That turns out to be up to the applications or the processes to do. It turns out there's a standardized way to do it, but it happens within the processes and not in the OS. Timing and throughput. Neither one of them is addressed here. They're just sort of background for the internet, right? You go out and you buy rent a link with a certain throughput characteristic. Usually your provider doesn't even tell you about latency, makes no claim about latency. And basically what happens is people just go out and buy bandwidth until they're satisfied. And by buying bandwidth at the edges, they provide the funding that's needed to by the bandwidth inside, and the whole thing has just grown that way. And so this whole thing about timing and minimum throughput is largely an accident. That's what it boils down to. The effort, the so-called best effort service over which all of this stuff is based, comes from ratcheting up the quality of that best effort service. Without ever standardizing it. It's kind of amazing. It's in some ways that it works. Okay, so you map stuff onto TCP or UDP, depending. There are some other protocols that live at this transport layer that sort of mix the TCP and UDP models to a certain extent. There are some protocols in the internet that allow you to express your requirements to the routers about what you're going to do. But it's sort of more of the form, I've told you what I intend to do, please help me out, than anything that shows up in the actual communication. Okay, so security, neither one of these things has security. If you use them in their raw form to retrieve your mail, to log into a server, fetch your bank information, you're stupid. Okay? That's all I can say. If you don't use any security, then what's happening is that when you type in your username and password, the whole world can read it. And that's not good. So, to solve this problem, and coming late to the game, probably roughly 20 years after, 15 to 20 years after the internet protocols, TCP and UDP got defined, we have something called SSL, which I guess more appropriately these days is called Transport Layer Security, TLS. SSL stands for Secure Socket Layer, but TLS is the more modern name. And what it does is provides encrypted TCP connections. So when you make a connection, and we'll talk about how this encryption stuff works toward the end of the class, you set up an encryption key that's specific to that connection, and it's used to encrypt all the traffic, and therefore your passwords are protected. We will talk about the importance of authentication. Right, there's encryption. This is worth saying multiple times, so I'll say it now. There's encryption, right, which is the process by which you hide the contents of messages from others. But just as important, there's authentication, which is the process by which you actually know to whom you are talking. So if you use encryption without authentication, what have you accomplished? Nothing, right? Because you may be talking to just the person who you don't want to be seeing your messages. SSL TLS is implemented in the application layer. Back here. A code library that lives in the application space. And so what happens is the application code that you write makes calls on that library, which in turn make the calls down into the transport layer. Okay, so it's implemented at the application layer. And so once you go through the process of setting this up, then you are hoping that your passwords and other confidential information are sent over the internet in an encrypted way that other people can't get to. Now, it turns out that this SSL TLS stuff is increasingly apparent that it's not very well designed for usability by mere mortals. And so, well, usability or implementation by mere mortals. So this is one of the areas where lots of mistakes are made in configuring the way that that application programs use SSL and the services that are provided. So recently there was a study about use of TLS by web browsers, which is how you get so-called HTTPS connections. We'll talk about this. A study sort of asking how well the browsers implement their use of TLS. And it turns out that many of the popular browsers use SSL facilities in such a way that the connections are in fact easily broken, given what's been learned about cryptography in the last 10 years. They're not negotiating. The problem is that the client and the server have to agree on what kind of authentication and encryption they're going to use, and the browser is sort of not negotiating a strong enough position in that negotiation to agreement. The browser is choosing a poor form of encryption and authentication, even though the server is willing to do a much stronger one. Okay? And this comes about because people are just not that familiar with all of the myriad implications of the different choices they have to make when they use SSL. So we can take a look at some of these papers later on. Okay, well, we'll start then on talking about, will we? I think I will not start talking about that. Rather, I will ask you to take a look at some questions. Yes. Okay. Just a little bit of review. These are not intended to be hard, but just to point out some of the important aspects. Okay. Yes. The client contacts the server. Okay. That one. In client-server architecture, the client usually has a fixed address, and the server may have different addresses at different times. True or false? Yeah, okay. You got it. Okay, this one's a little trickier. TCP is ideal for multimedia applications because it provides accurate delivery timing and guaranteed minimum throughput. Yeah.
By the way, Carl.
Yeah?
Do the clip questions get posted anywhere at some point?
Yeah, I will eventually post them.
With a lot of answer tickets? Or do we just keep them with ourselves?
Eventually, I got around to adding answers. I don't know that all of them will have answers, but you can research them. Okay, yeah, so this one is false. This one is false multiple times over, right? Why is it false?
Well, it doesn't provide accurate delivery timing.
It doesn't provide accurate delivery timing and guaranteed minimum throughput, and TCP is also not necessarily the ideal protocol for multimedia applications, right? Some of them may well work better over UDP. Okay. So, just for grins, three more things. No, don't answer that one. That's not what I wanted. I clicked on the wrong one. We'll save that one for later. Okay. This is just to encourage you to sort of review mentally today's lecture, what's important. I will take a look through these and see if I agree with the overall sentiment of the class. And if I don't, what does that mean? It means I didn't communicate what I thought was important. So that's the point of questions like this, is to help me understand whether I have communicated what I think is important to you.
Is it the matter for specific, or can we just be abstract?
You can be as you know. The point is to try to see whether I've communicated. So, and I get 30 people's input, and I get a pretty good picture of what was communicated. So, okay, is everybody done with that? Anybody still working? All right. Two more requests. This is the next to last one. Is there anything from the lectures so far, not just today, but sort of the whole five of them, that is unclear or needs further explanation? Anybody else? I can just leave that one up. And last but not least, thinking over the whole five lectures so far. Wait a second. Don't. I'm gonna ask you if you already answered that. Start over again. Okay. Starting now. Where do we stand on this? Thank you. So let me tell you what the result of that one was. 26 people said new. 14 people said review. And 2 people said bored. And there are about 30 people here today. So make of that what you will. So, you know, I think that's relatively good. And with that, we'll end today, and next time we'll start in on HTTP, and I will give the assignment. Sorry,